listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
According to an assessment made public by the U.S. intelligence community in January, RT is the Kremlin's, and I quote, principal international propaganda outlet, end quote.
That was U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat from New Hampshire, on the floor of the Senate last week as she argued for a grant of additional powers to the Justice Department to investigate potential violations of the 1938 U.S. Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA. Shaheen has been particularly vocal about her claims that Russian media pose a major threat to U.S. national security, saying on more than one occasion that, quote, Russian propaganda has a body count, closed quote.
And it's integral to Russia's information warfare operations across the globe. The Kremlin selects the staff for RT and closely supervises RT's coverage, including disinformation and false news stories designed to undermine our democracy. If you have any question about that, watch RT here. It's on the cable network here in the D.C. area. RT News has publicly boasted that it can dodge our laws by claiming to be financed by a nonprofit organization and not by the Russian government. Well, recently, the Department of Justice asked RT America to, in fact, register as a foreign agent.
First passed in the lead-up to World War II to protect against German influence in the U.S., the act requires foreign governments, political parties, and lobbyists to register with the Department of Justice. Last week, the Justice Department required Russia's international news agency, RT, to register as agents of a foreign government, the only news agency required to do so as of RT's Monday filing. Under the act, RT will be required to disclose financial data and personal information of its employees. But such news agencies as the UK's BBC, Israel's I-24, and Saudi Arabia's Al Arabiya have not been required to register as foreign agents under FARA. Nevertheless, it appears that the censors in Congress are only just getting started. According to Reuters on Thursday, a report to the U.S. Congress released on Wednesday accused China state media entities of spying and propaganda and said their staff in the U.S. should be required to register as agents of a foreign government. The annual report was issued by the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission, created by Congress in the year 2000 to monitor the national security implications of U.S.-China trade relations. The report claims that China's state media expansion is part of a broad effort to exert greater control over how China is depicted globally, as well as to gather information. The report highlighted in particular Xinhua News Agency. It noted that Xinhua had offices at the UN in New York, in Washington, Chicago, Los Angeles, Houston, and San Francisco. The report claims that Xinhua, quote, serves some of the functions of an intelligence agency by gathering information and producing classified reports for the Chinese leadership on both domestic and international events, closed quote. It also cited testimony by U.S. government-funded Freedom House, calling the fact that individuals working for Xinhua and China's People's Daily newspaper were not covered by FARA a loophole. Russia, though, has held a special place in the heart of the U.S. government ever since the Bolshevik Revolution 100 years ago this month. That anniversary was recently noted by RT's self-styled bullhorns of propaganda on the channel's flagship program, Crosstalk. We spoke with one of those bullhorns, the only Russian among the group, Sputnik journalist Dmitry Babich, earlier this week via Skype from his office in Moscow. Dmitry, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Thank you.
So I watched Crosstalk this week looking at the Russian Revolution. An interesting conversation with you, Peter, Mark, and I forgot the gentleman's name from, I think he's from
Jeffrey
Ireland.
Jeffrey Roberts.
Yes.
A historian from Ireland, but actually he is British, but he is teaching in Ireland now, yes.
Yes, an interesting, I mean, each one of you, different perspective, but out of all of them, you're the only one that's actually Russian. Mark is an American living in Russia, so is Peter, and we have a Brit living in Ireland. And the conversation was in English, airing for the benefit of audiences in the English-speaking world. I watched it here in New York. You were striking, each person had interesting things to say. You were striking on something towards the beginning, which is a point that we've sort of touched on also and that I've heard you discuss at other times, and that is the similarities between the totalitarianism that has been at least imputed to and manifest some in the Soviet state.
Yes.
And the totalitarianism that exists in the United States today, or in the West today, and that being the definition of it, meaning essentially that a very small group of people hold the levers of government and economic and information power, military power, all of the levers of power in a very small set of hands.
Well, that's true, but not necessarily. Sometimes you have a greater number of people. What is important is that you have a very intolerant and a very aggressive ideology in power, which tries to monopolize its view on history. It tries to monopolize its view on family. So if you look at the first years of the Bolshevist Revolution, you will see a lot of similarities with the United States now. You'll see the destruction of monuments, which is guided by the idea that we can review history. We can do away with parts of the past that don't fit our narrative. Then you have fear of talking to foreigners. Like in the United States, we have a new Russian ambassador in Washington, D.C. right now, and he can't meet a single U.S. congressman. They're all scared to death. You know, they're all unable to talk to him, not because he is scared, but because they're scared. That reminds me of the worst days of the Soviet Union. It reminds me of 1953, you know, when Molotov's wife was imprisoned simply for talking to the Israeli ambassador. It reminds me of the times when the Russian, or rather the Soviet diplomats abroad, they didn't call themselves ambassadors. They called themselves plenipotentiary representatives. Why? Because they thought that in a few years, all the world will be Soviet Union, all the world will be communist. So they didn't want to be called ambassadors. Well, if you look at the actions of, say, Michael McFaul in Russia when he was the American ambassador here, he behaved exactly like the Soviet ambassadors in the 20s. He basically viewed himself as a person who can start revolutions here, who can teach people how they can improve democracy here, not even improve, how they can topple the government and get a better system, you know. He was not afraid and he was not ashamed of basically lecturing Russians on the right way to get rid of their government. So there are so many similarities, and I would say that these similarities are mostly the negative ones. There was a lot of positive things about the Soviet Union, including the early Soviet Union, which are not to be seen in the United States right now. You know, the idea that people should have equal access to education, that education should be free, that basic health services should be free, all of that is absolutely absent in the United States now. So the United States has a lot of similarities with the early Soviet Union, but mostly the most negative things. The lack of freedom, I would say, is for everyone to see.
Now, the at the time that, you know, post-revolutionary Russia, I'm focusing on at the moment, you had a condition where, you know, there was war. The Bolsheviks came to power because they said, you know, enough war. They promised peace, bread, and land, essentially. And that won the hearts of workers, people in the military, and peasants. And they delivered those things, although there were political struggles. On the one hand, there was the model that developed there. We have seen in other places, however, where that model was not developed, what happened to those regimes. I'm thinking, for example, anywhere from Mossadegh to Chile in 1970s, you know, a number of other places where even moderate socialist governments were treated ruthlessly by the United States and crushed, in some very ugly periods of actual overt fascism in places like Chile, for example, or in Iran, or what followed. What kinds of possibilities, this is, of course, just speculating, but what kinds of things could have happened, do you think, that where, say, the path away from the one that was followed might have been pursued, yet delivering the good things that were delivered, such as free education, health care, you know, defeating fascism, by the way, things like that?
Well, I mean, you probably remember the image that I used during our conversation. I said that the Russian Revolution reminds me of an elephant in a dark room,
yes,
touched by three blind philosophers. You know, one of them touches the leg and says, oh, an elephant is something like a column, right?
Right, right.
The other one touches the trunk and says, oh, no, this is something much more flexible.
Right.
Then the third one touches the tail and says, no, you are both wrong. The elephant is something like a rope.
Right.
So, I mean, if you look at the Russian Revolution, and of course, there was a certain unity between February, when basically a liberal provisional government came to power, toppling the Tsar. It was done with the help of the military, who actually had a conspiracy against the Tsar. Without February, October would not be possible,
right,
you know,
that's
with
correct.
A yep. radical leftist party coming to power in Russia. So, again, coming back to that metaphor of an elephant, of course, there are many people in Russia, including President Putin, who view and who see primarily the negative side of the revolution. I mean, if you're just a grown-up person living in 1917, you know, the fall in the standard of living was dramatic. Already in 1918, people lived several times worse.
Oh, yeah. Well, you were coming off 4 years of war or something at that point in time, a very destructive war and all kinds of other problems that predated the revolution.
So if you want to look at the revolution from the point of view of tragedy, you know, which it was for millions of people, then it's very easy to find facts. You know, there was a dramatic fall in the standard of living. The normal exchange between the village and the city was destroyed in 1918 for a number of reasons.
Right.
And it was not actually the Bolsheviks who did all the destruction. You know, the Tsar started it because in 1916, in order to win the war, Russia sort of remade its industry to serve the military purposes. So the peasants didn't get their usual share of industrial goods, you know, to exchange for agricultural products.
Right.
That happened back in 1916, even before the Tsar was toppled. So something terrible was going to happen. There was going to be disruption. There were going to be confiscations if the cities were to survive. But of course, the revolution made it a lot more painful, a lot more dramatic. So that was the negative side. The positive side, it was indeed the first country in Europe and in the world which proclaimed that everyone has the right to free education, and the education was free.
Yep.
It was not ideal. A lot of it, of course, fighting against illiteracy started back in the times of the Tsar. I mean, the number of literate people in Russia was growing rapidly in what the mathematicians would call a geometrical progression starting from 1890s. But it was the communists, the leftists, who brought it all to the glorious end in the 20s and 30s. Mm. Again, the other question is, did the Bolsheviks, by coming to power, did they scare the German bourgeoisie so that the German bourgeoisie would choose Hitler and his so-called National Socialists as the new government of Germany? Yes. The Bolsheviks did scare the German bourgeoisie. On the other hand, would Russia be capable of defeating Hitler and his Nazis with the people like Kerensky and his liberal provisional government, ruling Russia?
Right.
No way.
Right.
So you have a situation where for every yes you have a no.
Yeah.
And this is the problem because the revolution is still a very passionate subject in Russia.
Of course.
And when you start talking to an average person, immediately you see either a radical on one side saying that the revolution was bad from A to Z, or you have the opposite view, like it was good from A to Z. No, the revolution was like an elephant, as I told you. And if we look at it, we have to look at it as a whole. We should not be like one of these blind philosophers just touching the tail or touching the leg. If you look at the general result, I would say that the revolution did more. It did more for the countries of post-war Europe, for countries like Norway, Sweden, even France or Germany. It did more for them than it did for the Russian people, because the Russian people had to go through the bad side of the experiment. The moderate governments in the post-war years, they took all the good lessons. Now, unfortunately, the situation is different. We see another aggressive, monopolistic, totalitarian ideology coming to power in the United States and in the European Union, showing all the bad sides of Bolshevism without any of its good sides, capable of aligning with itself with Nazism, especially in places like Ukraine, in places like Croatia, capable of aligning itself with radical religious fanaticism, like the West, in fact, allied itself with Sunni radicals in Syria.
Right.
If you look at the Soviet Union, there was only one instance when there was a kind of a temporary truce between the Soviet Union and the Nazi forces. That was in the immediate aftermath of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Well, in the West now, we see an alliance with Ukrainian Nazis, with Croatian Nazis, with Baltic Nazis, with Libyan and Syrian radical Sunni Islamists. We've seen it continuing for years, probably for decades.
Yeah.
So if you ask me who was worse, you know, communism or the current ultra-liberalism, I'm at pains to answer. Nazism was certainly worse than the other two.
Yeah, right,
but
for sure.
the problem is that Stalin in 1939 and modern West, especially in the last 20 years, they have shown themselves of being capable, even of aligning themselves with Nazis temporarily.
Well, okay, so just to follow the logic of the argument that, or looking at the flip side, really, of the argument that Bolshevik Revolution produced benefits in the West by holding up examples of free healthcare, free education, universal suffrage, you know, many things like that. That these were basically induced in the Western countries where the bourgeoisie was looking at the Soviet Union saying, oh my God, if we don't make some concessions to our workers, they're going to go that way and string us up like the Romanovs. And excuse me, the flip side of that is now that we have this, you know, situation existing in the West, are there benefits being induced in, say, Russia and China by the developments in the United States, or the development in particular of this ideological, you know, monstrosity?
Well, maybe in an indirect way, because, I mean, if the European Union and the United States did not act so aggressively against Russia in Ukraine, in the former Yugoslavia, in Syria, in Georgia, probably Vladimir Putin would not have been so different from Boris Yeltsin. Because in the 90s, the Russian elite felt like we're going to have prosperity for ourselves forever. Right. We're going to sell oil and gas to the European Union. The European Union is our privileged partner, right, preferably the only one. And I remember Putin's early years in power. That was not very different from his actions, at least in the beginning. There was one major difference from Yeltsin. Putin realized that Russia could not afford an agreement or an appeasement of terrorists in Chechnya, especially those connected to Saudi Arabia. So he acted much more decisively there, and we now have peace there. But economically, I mean, if you look at the first years of Putin in power, he continued the same policy of basically gearing the Russian economy to the European Union. He made lots of concessions in order to join the WTO. And now, obviously, there's a lot of questions about WTO. Do we really need it if WTO does not prevent the European Union and the United States from imposing sanctions on us? According to WTO rules, you can only impose sanctions if there is a decision by the Security Council of the United Nations. So,
right,
from the purely legal point of view, almost all of the American sanctions, except maybe the ones they imposed on the North Korean regime, they're all illegal. Right. So, in a way, I think the monstrous ultra-liberal or neoliberal ideology, which is now reigning in the United States and in the EU, by antagonizing the Russian elite, by antagonizing, to a lesser extent, the Chinese elite, I think it made these elites do more for their peoples. It's a bizarre situation, but that is how history develops.
Yeah.
Whenever you have an impression that one ideology is going to sweep the world, never to be replaced, immediately you have more exploitation. Immediately you have a monopoly of rich people on the media. Immediately you have a hysteria of making everything as I want in a second. You know, you have all of these hysterical changes, like I want everything to be .com tomorrow, I want everything to be blockchain tomorrow, you know, without the conflicts, the periodical conflicts between the predators, I don't think people would survive in general.
That's interesting. Periodic conflicts between predators. You're talking about the clashing interests of separate elites.
That's exactly true. So in a way, I think in Europe, in the post-war years, they introduced all these social reforms, not just because they imitated the good experiences of the Soviet Union. Not all of these experiences were very successful. They were just afraid that leftists would come to power in a legal way.
Right.
It was very possible in the countries like Italy, France, even in places like Spain. You know, it was possible when Franco was toppled in 1974. In the immediate aftermath of Franco's fall, it was it looked possible that leftists would come to power, as they did in some countries of Latin America.
You know, the United States has had a long history of regime change and then taking the subject nations, turning them essentially into storehouses for raw materials and surplus labor. I'm speaking here in particular of the Monroe Doctrine, where the Western Hemisphere was made available to American capital from the beginning of the 19th century. And we've seen that model developing across the world, where the U.S. supplanted the older colonial powers like Spain, France in the 19th century, Spain at the end of the 19th century, and those that were left after the two world wars. But we also have seen a similar situation, really, with respect to the West towards the Soviet Union, the former republics, including Russia, which is kind of the context in which Yeltsin came to power, and particularly the result was that the elite, as he described it, was perfectly happy there to let Russia be, you know, an oil well for the people of Western Europe and a bank for themselves. This has changed some. And what we're seeing across the, like the BRICS, regional groupings like CELAC, for example, or the SCO and others, are large chunks of the global economy busting away from this economic construct and political economy. Does Russia have a role? Right now, Russia's playing a role as a guarantor of the sovereignty of particularly itself and China with its strategic weaponry. And it also has a considerable technological base that it offers to the newly assembling economic structure. But is there a real, like, a central political and role for Russia in this rising multipolarity?
Well, I think that actually Russia did not have any cunning plans on surviving in this new world. The Trump of Russia, if you want, I'm sorry for the pun here, but the real Trump of Russia is the stupidity and the absurdity of the modern West. I don't want to say that all the people living in the United States or in Western Europe are stupid,
right,
but the ideology which is prevailing in Western Europe and in the United States is extremely stupid.
Yes.
It certainly did not learn anything from 1917. The problem is that this ideology demonizes 1917, but it considers 1917 a lesson only to Russians,
right,
not even to Ukrainians or the Latvians or the Georgians, people who lived in the former Soviet Union. And coming back to your question, Coming back to your question, what lies ahead and why are we in this situation? Well, I would say that Russia is now groping for the way forward. I think the main crisis is already behind us because I think the most difficult decisions were taken in 2014, you know, after the Maidan coup in Ukraine. Then Putin had to face a choice. Either we acquire to ultra-liberalism or we act. And he chose to act. Lots of people said, you will be dead next minute. We are not dead.
Right.
We were successful in Syria. We survived and we continue to survive the sanctions. The Ukrainian regime is a terrible failure of the West. So basically what we see is that you can resist ultra-liberalism. It is not invincible. This is the main lesson of the last 3 years. For the first time since the late 80s, when it started its expansion, ultra-liberalism suffered several defeats. It suffered a defeat in Syria, it suffered a defeat in Crimea, it suffered a defeat now with North Korea. It is in the process of suffering that defeat. And these are all very reassuring developments. The question is, will our elite have the courage to continue, or will they try to go back? I hope they realize that there is simply no way back.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Recent events coming out of Saudi Arabia are truly stunning. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is said to be a reformer and on an anti-corruption drive. Others say differently. Saudi Arabia is experiencing a life-threatening crisis that could ignite a region-wide conflict. And the Trump administration appears to be on board. Crosstalking Saudi Arabia, I'm joined by my guest, Martin Jay, in Beirut. He is a freelance broadcast journalist. Also in Beirut, we have Halim Shabaya. He is a political analyst. And in Washington, we have Joe Macaron. He is a policy analyst at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Martin, let me go to you first in Beirut. There are so many elements of what's going on with the story domestically in Saudi Arabia and, of course, across the region, particularly in Lebanon, which of course always includes Iran. If you could, for our audience, because it's not getting a lot of airtime because of domestic politics in the U.S. and the U.K., how would you sum up what's actually going on in Saudi Arabia and in the region? Go ahead, Martin.
Well, there's a link between both of them. I mean, Saudi Arabia is basically getting ready for a new king to take the throne, and that is Mohammed bin Salman, the new crown prince who has been installed in that position by Israel and America, and is very insecure about his position and very insecure about the future. So he's created a sort of anti-corruption purge, which no one really believes, and is basically wiping out all of the opposition, anybody who's a rival to him, anybody who could question him or doubt him and give him problems in the future. But concurrent to that, what we've seen the last few weeks is more attacks on the Saudi capital from Yemen, which is linked to the whole Hariri thing, and basically a massive fuse blowing in Riyadh, where this entourage of people around Mohammed bin Salman have basically said, "Our man in Lebanon, Mr. Hariri, is not doing enough for us. He really hasn't done anything for us in the last year in terms of rebalancing this power balance that we have in the Middle East between, on one side, Saudi Arabia and all the Western and Gulf Arab countries, and on the other side, Iran and its affiliates." Basically, Saudi Arabia has lost so much in the last 5 years that for this new Saudi prince to come into power, he needs to feel as though he's making a statement, he needs to send a message to Iran, but he also is sort of holding out a hand to Hezbollah via Hariri to say, can't you just give us a little bit back, just show a little bit of humility? We lost so much in Syria, we lost so much in Yemen, we've made fools of ourselves in Qatar.
But let me go to Joe. Does that help politics works in the Middle East? I mean, give me something? No, I don't think it works that way. I mean, Saudi foreign policy has been nothing less than a catastrophe over the last few years. I mean, and then going back in and meddling in Lebanon, trying to rebalance, whatever that means, it's up to the Lebanese people to do that. What is, in your mind, what is going on in Saudi Arabia? Go ahead, Joe, in Washington.
I mean, obviously, there's an attempt to grab power. The Saudi political system became very complicated. A lot of princes, a lot of branches inside the ruling family that wants to control. And obviously, he wants to consolidate power since he came. He's on a fast track. He's making people worried, whether in Washington or in other capitals around the world. And this is not only impacting, of course, the Saudi internal dynamics. It's having impact on Lebanon, on Yemen, on Qatar, we saw. So there's a way, there's a little bit of accumulation of crisis in that sense. And for that reason, I see the what's happening inside Lebanon is mostly linked to Saudi politics.
Right.
And this is the scary part in that sense.
Okay, well, Halim, if I can go to you, also in Beirut, I mean, if the Crown Prince wants to make a big splash, if I can use that term, well, it's all completely backfired on him in Lebanon. I mean, instead of seeding division, we've actually seen unity, and even quite a few Western players are a bit frustrated that, you know, the Saudi Arabia is destabilizing Lebanon, and that's not it's not very difficult to destabilize Lebanon. Lebanon's a very fragile place. Go ahead, in Beirut.
Yeah, well, I'll just add to what the guest said before about Crown Prince bin Salman, is that, yes, on the one hand, he is trying to capitalize power prior to taking on the throne of the Saudi kingdom. But at the same time, he's kind of tapping into some reforms that have gotten a bit of positive review internally and also externally. So he's using that, perhaps, for example, beside the issue of the anti-reform agenda, he's using some of his statements on the need for social change and the need to, you know, address change the way the country is going for the last 30 years with, you know, giving women the right to drive and other issues, speaking to the youth. So that's on one hand kind of to also complete the picture in terms of what I believe Crown Prince bin Salman is doing. But also when we get to Lebanon, yes, indeed. I mean, we can't say with certainty that he has lost yet. Absolutely, as you rightly said, there has been a display of national unity given what has happened in the last 2 weeks or less than 2 weeks since Hariri's resignation, which was extremely bizarre, and it was described as bizarre not just by the anti-Hariri media or the pro-Hezbollah media. It was described as bizarre even by the international media, given that you have a prime minister who is missing in action in Riyadh. But at the moment, I just want to also add this issue, the point that anything we say at the moment is really uncertain, given that we have not heard from Hariri face to face. And he mentioned in his interview on Sunday, November 12th, that there are a lot of secrets that he can only tell when he comes to Lebanon and speak to President Town.
Okay, well, let me go back to Martin. Uncertainty is the worst thing you need in a situation like this here. I want to go back to the issue of reform. And we had the Crown Prince and people around him talking about moderate Islam. That is remarkable coming out of Riyadh. I mean, if he's, you know, like a bull in a china shop, you know, with his purge and like that, I mean, does he could have the political strength, a base to be able to do something like that? Because I have to wonder if that's just for Western consumption. That's my first takeaway. Go ahead, Martin.
No, I think you've banged the nail firmly on the head. Yes, the question that all journalists and analysts want to ask is the same one. How long will this guy be around? You know, when you're going to those measures, when you're going to such extreme measures to create all this distraction, all this smoke and mirrors. I mean, the whole Hariri drama is in many ways a distraction from what's going on in Riyadh right now, which is chaos and calamity. You know, I mean, what's not getting reported by Western journalists is the crackdown, the human rights abuses, and the crackdown on people being detained without trial and even being beheaded. And some of these people are political opponents. So I don't think we can talk about reform. I mean, I think when Halim mentioned reformed, I think he was very kind to MBS. I think letting women drive and maybe creating some program which may or may not work in 2030, and you know, having a minister of fun is all really very superficial and doesn't really have that much substance to it. You know, what we're seeing, I think, is Saudi Arabia going backwards. You know, I don't see anything going forward. I'm not at all positive. And I think the fact that you need to go to those measures, you need to take those extremes, you need to use your man Hariri in Lebanon to try and destabilize a tiny country. And you said it yourself, yeah. You know, it's easy to destabilize Lebanon. It's poor, it's backward, it basically hasn't really ever had a functional government in the 5 years I've been here. You know, so it's low-hanging fruit in terms of, you know, shaking that particular country. But I mean, I don't think we can take this guy seriously. I mean, what's happened with the Hariri drama is the whole thing has massively backfired. Look what's happened in Lebanon. You'll find now.
Yes, it's nothing less than bizarre here. Let me go back to Joe here. I mean, we had the president of the United States, his first major foreign visit, and he went to, among the cities on his trip, was to Riyadh. And the Twitter-in-chief is giving full support to the crown prince here. Is there any cause and effect there? Because does he feel like he's got kind of like a blank check from the U.S.? Because, you know, maybe his Twitter account, you know, that gives him a blank check from the president, but from the rest of the U.S. administration, it doesn't seem so clear. Again, this is very callous, risky behavior. Go ahead, Joe.
Yes, I mean, obviously there's some policy differences between the White House on one hand and then the State Department and the Pentagon on the other hand. We saw in the Qatar crisis for them to bridge that difference took a while, and then eventually the president called the Egyptian president when they were meeting in Cairo and asked them basically to stop the escalation, and basically they didn't force a solution on them, but they asked them to stop the escalation. In the case of Lebanon, that bridge was much quicker. I'm not sure, maybe because Tillerson was in with Trump on the trip. But it became more, and basically the U.S. was able to curb the Saudi surge, if you're going to call it, in Lebanon, and basically tell them, tone down the rhetoric, the government going to stay, we need stability, we're not going to play with fire now. So we saw suddenly the Saudi rhetoric retreated in a very clear and gradual way, leading now to Hariri moving around. So yes, there's a big tension on around this issue, and I think the concern is at the expense of building a good relation with Trump and his advisor, including Kushner, is coming at the expense of the Saudi relation with the U.S. establishment. Yeah. Because they feel now, you are undercutting us.
Exactly.
We didn't know about Lebanon.
Exactly.
We didn't know about Qatar. You're just playing with fire, impacting our influence, our U.S. forces in Qatar, our U.S. Influence in Lebanon.
Yeah, but
so
we have to
at some point be on the
exactly.
same wavelength.
I think we're agreeing here. Let me go, Halim, let me go to you. I mean, again, I mean, because the position of the U.S. is very ambivalent here, does it give the players on the ground a little bit more elbow room to do what they want to do? Because it seems like that's in play, including the Israelis, by the way. Go ahead.
Yes, I agree. But of course, we need to remember that we still, even when you're reading the U.S. press and other reports, we still don't know exactly what Trump's policy is in the Middle East. But having said that, we know one thing, is that he's decided to single out Iran as the main threat in the region. And
exactly.
In doing so, he has completely adopted the line of Israel and Saudi Arabia. Now, whether his plan is well thought out, whether he has practical steps in doing that, we know in the case of Lebanon, there has been increasing sanctions by the U.S. Congress against Hezbollah and against affiliated groups.
Gentlemen, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break, and after that break, we'll continue our discussion on Saudi Arabia and some on Iran. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World
from CPR.
Okay, Martin, let me go back to you. Halim brought up the topic where I wanted to go with on this program. Let's talk about the Iran angle here. I mean, it seems that that's part of the chessboard right here. Is the Crown Prince trying to make some kind of grand gesture, or leave his footprint in history? I mean, again, looking what's going on the region, failure in Syria, failure in Yemen. I mean, maybe you should kind of step back a little bit here, destabilizing Lebanon. I mean, now we have this rhetorical war, which is always there to one level or another. But I mean, it looks like he's priming up the region to get used to a conflict with Iran, and of course, the Israelis officially, unofficially, are always kind of egging that along there too. So, I mean, this is what I find very worrisome. Someone that is not experienced coming in, like a bull in a china shop, kicking everything around, arresting people, worse. Taking their assets away, and we have the U.S. that's kind of asleep at the wheel, seemingly at least. Martin, your thoughts, Iran?
Yeah, because basically, to sum it up, the American idea, or the Trump camp's idea, is that whatever we do with Iran in the Middle East, we can't really go wrong. There is this idea that there is a huge safety net there, and whatever they actually try and pull off, whatever initiative is, whether it's a military one or whether it's what I believe will be an economic sanction crackdown, call it what you will, on Lebanon, they feel as though that there's no accountability. It's almost as though they're creating policies which in 3, 4, or 5 years time they will not be accountable to anyway. But what we are seeing, what we're witnessing in the Middle East, particularly with Saudi Arabia and Lebanon, and with this whole context of Iran, is Saudi Arabia and Israel coming closer and closer together with this paranoia which is being stirred and provoked and goaded by the Trump administration, particularly since that not signing the certification for the Iran deal sign off a couple of weeks ago. This just makes things much worse. The Hezbollah, who are believed to be in Yemen firing rockets at Riyadh, It's just stoking everything up, and it's reached a point now where no logical argument matters anymore. Just today, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia said, we are talking now to our allies about a new policy towards Iran. Well, what does that mean? They cannot, in MBS's wildest dreams, he cannot possibly imagine a military campaign against Iran or Hezbollah in Lebanon. Can he be that mad?
Yeah, well, no. He's not mad. He's just going to get the Americans and the Israelis to do it, and that's what really worries me, okay? Joe, let me go to you. I mean,
it's not going
to
work.
I agree, okay? Martin, when has it worked recently, okay? And that's the whole point I want to go with Joe here in Washington. Okay, let's look at Iraq, okay? Iraq, after the illegal invasion and occupation 2003, it falls into Iran's sphere of influence, okay? Now you have this proxy war in Syria. Who comes out the winner? Iran, okay? I mean, Hezbollah goes in and fights ISIS. So they carry water for the Iranians, okay? They win again. Now, why in the world would anyone on the crown of the Saudi royal family thinking they're going to throw the dice one more time? I mean, it's mistake, one after another. Oh, sorry, I forgot Yemen. Go ahead, Joe.
I mean, I believe that the Saudis, never have a plan to confront Iran. I mean, they never have the intention, to confront Iran, not in the past and not today. And this is why they went to what I call the weakest link, which is Lebanon and Yemen. This is where they can basically force the hand of Iran, but they cannot in Syria and they cannot in Iraq. So yes, the rhetoric, the U.S. and Saudi rhetoric, is basically getting higher or more tense with Iran in the past year or so. But this does not translate into policy on the ground, because we see in Syria there's an agreement now between the U.S. and Russian. You see Iranian getting close to control the Iraqi-Syrian border. In the Iraq, you have Saudi engagement now. You have coexistence between the U.S. and Iran and Iraq through Abadi and through the stabilizing situation over there. So the rhetoric doesn't match what's happening on the ground. And this was the U.S. message to Saudi Arabia, that we want Lebanon to explode everything for us, that it's very tricky what's happening. We have to deal with the situation in Syria, try to contain Iran. That's not the time to go into a conflict. That's not a big priority for the U.S. at this point, which is Lebanon. Lebanon. And you see now there's a completely shift in that sense. So again, I mean, the Saudi rhetoric does not match and will not match anytime soon the rhetoric, especially in Lebanon, where the Saudi options are very, very, very limited.
Yeah. Halim, let's talk more about Lebanon. I mean, I think we all can agree that it's not over yet, whatever this gambit is, okay? But, you know, the first signs are they've solidified. I mean, people have come together. Explain to our viewers what kind of consensus is there now in dealing with this situation. They're seeing this foreign meddling from Saudi Arabia, and it's sent shivers through the spine of a lot of people. Because, I mean, to remind our viewers that, you know, people remember the war, the civil war. It was horrific. It was long, and they found some kind of consensus to move forward with lots of disagreements and a very complicated political system. Is it durable? Can it pull through this crisis? Go ahead, in Beirut.
In my opinion, the consensus is that we do not want, that the Lebanese people do not want another war. They do not want to be dragged into another war on behalf of somebody else. But for the, you know, for the sake of having also a comprehensive analysis of what the view is from Lebanon and also in the region, we need to talk about obviously Saudi interference, but we also need to talk about Iranian involvement in Lebanon. As you well know, Hezbollah is an Iranian ally and has a lot of, you know, power in Lebanon, but it's also been involved in the Syria crisis and possibly in the Yemen crisis and in Iraq as well. So we can't really discuss Lebanon without talking about these two sides, which is usually what is discussed today as the regional power play between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So yes, in the last 2 weeks, Saudi Arabia's role interfering in Lebanon and what I consider to be an assault on Lebanon's sovereignty has come to the surface. But we also need to see that it's part of a bigger problem of both powers trying to interfere, trying to flex their muscles, so to speak. So let me also remind the viewers that part of what also Saudi Arabia claimed, at least, that this is all about, or what its allies in Lebanon were upset about, was President Rouhani of Iran, who mentioned 2 weeks ago perhaps that nothing happens in the region, including Lebanon, without the without Iran's consent. So in one way or another, one can see the Hariri resignation as Saudi Arabia saying, well, look, we can also influence things on the ground. We can put a halt on a settlement that brought President Aoun to the presidency and Saad al-Hariri to the premiership. So in some ways, just to sum it up briefly,
sure,
there is a consensus that we do not want a war. If Saudi Arabia wants a military confrontation with Hezbollah, it is my view that no party in Lebanon wants that. But at the same time, what the Hariri resignation brought forward is that there is a need to have a discussion about the status of Hezbollah going forward and also whether Hezbollah should disengage from any regional conflicts.
Well, Martin, weigh in on that, because, I mean, Hezbollah would say nothing succeeds like success. I mean, they play their cards very, very carefully, okay? And they've come out on top. And
that's right.
They are also part of the political process. They are elected democratically, if you like it or not, okay? Mm. So, you know, it seems to me that they have a pretty strong position in Lebanese politics, okay? And they came about because of the illegal invasion of Israel, okay? Let's all remember the origins of all these things. Go ahead, Martin.
Well, yeah, I mean, Hezbollah started off as very much a nationalistic organization, but has grown and developed now into an organization which permits right across the region. You know, the problem we've got here is one of irony. The Saudis tried to take on Iran and Hezbollah's proxy around the region, and they lost. And every time they keep losing, Hezbollah keeps growing. You know, if you look at Hezbollah now, I mean, the Israeli generals, barely a week passes without Israeli generals in the press down there in Israel talking about the strength of Israel since Hezbollah has come back from the war in Syria. So, you know, the joke of where does the 600-pound gorilla sit when it enters the room, anywhere it likes, applies very much to the situation that we have now between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The problem for the Saudis is Hezbollah has just become too big, too powerful across the region. And now the Saudis are negotiating from a point of weakness, not from a point of strength. You know, they've sort of kidnapped the Lebanese prime minister. We don't know exactly even where he is exactly or what he's doing in Saudi Arabia. There is this debacle now which has emerged between now the international community and France is trying to usher him back to France. There's a huge question mark over whether he will come back as a prime minister and do what everyone wants him to do, which is to talk to Hezbollah, because frankly he's the only one the Saudis have got, who can actually be put into that circle and who will be listened to and who can communicate with Hezbollah and come out with a deal. But the million-dollar question is, do the Saudis really want to negotiate a deal? Because they had an opportunity and they seem to have lost it.
I agree.
Ironically, Hariri has become so popular in the last 2 weeks, more popular than he could be ever in an entire political career inside Lebanon, and yet the Saudis have not capitalized on that and said, let's put him back into Beirut to talk to Hezbollah.
Joe, weigh in on that. That's a very interesting way of looking at it. Go ahead, Joe, in Washington.
I mean, I agree that Hezbollah's role in that sense has grown beyond its Lebanese role, and that should be discussed in a way that doesn't impact, you know, the way Lebanon has relation with the Arab world. And there's a concern about how Hezbollah is investing, what's happening in Syria and Lebanese politics. I don't understand why they were rushed to normalization with Damascus. Those are all, I think, legal concerns, legitimate concern to have. But the issue is how Saudi Arabia approached this issue. I mean, the way they did it now, basically, they crippled their own ally. He's somehow now basically forced to resign. He had to change all his rhetoric. And this weakened him. And this is not the first time they weakened Hariri. They've been weakening him for almost 5 years now, whether in his company in Saudi Arabia, whether supporting people on his right. So basically, I mean, they should take a decision that what else they can do. I mean, if they're going to go war with Hezbollah, there's no one ready for that. If they want Israel to go to war with Hezbollah, they are not ready for that. If they want the Americans to do that, they are not ready to basically also paralyze the Lebanese government. So no gay plan.
We've run out of time. I think Joe has really put it really well. There's no game plan here. That's what worries me. Many thanks to my guests in Beirut and in Washington. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.